Welcome to Puro Politics, the political podcast of San Antonio Express News. My name is Gilbert Garcia, opinion writer and columnist, and I'm joined by
Kerry Clack, columnist, editorial board.
And I think you've heard us talk a lot over the last few months about District 121 in Texas. It's a Texas House district that includes Alamo Heights, Terrell Hills, Olmos Park, a lot of North San Antonio. It's been a Republican seat for a long time, but our guest today is going to try to do something about that. Laurel Jordan Swift is the Democratic nominee in District 121, and she'll be facing attorney Mark LaHood in the November election. She's a lifelong San Antonian. She's worked in medical sales for many years. We learned before we started that she also has a history in radio, and we want to get some discussion in on that. She's raised five kids, and this is her first time running for political office. Laurel, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you all so much for having me. What an honor. I'm very excited to be here.
I guess the obvious question is, you know, that You've jumped in. I think you said you were drinking from the fire hose. What made you decide, after never doing anything like this before, that you wanted to run in the 2024 election cycle?
Well, I'll tell you this. I'm going to admit I voted Republican most of my life. I wasn't paying close attention. Mm-hmm. I was working. You know, I got married when I was at UT. And I was pregnant and we got married and mm-hmm. had three kids. I didn't graduate from college until I was 29, I think, mm-hmm. from UTSA. I got a degree in biology. Then I went to work and I was like, we've got to raise them. We got to make money. We got three kids. We got to send to college soon. So all I did was work and raise kids. And I had family members with mental illness. My mom developed bipolar disorder when I was 18 or 19. And it was pretty severe. She would have episodes. She was okay for periods of time. Mm. And then she would have episodes where she would just disappear and the cops would return her. Very nice, wonderful, wonderful police officers would return her and she'd be hospitalized and get back to normal. So we dealt with that. And then at the same time, my brother, who graduated from high school just a year behind me, he was most likely to succeed, just like Richie Cunningham, like the best kid, like everyone's favorite guy. And he developed schizophrenia in college. and at the same time, my dad was becoming a pretty big alcoholic. And so there was kind of the wheels came off my wonderful family. And being the oldest daughter, there was always an emergency here or there, you know, to go fix. Sure. And on top of raising kids and getting a job and working and earning money to eventually pay for college. So I really was busy and I didn't pay a lot of attention to as much attention to politics. I don't think anybody paid as much attention to politics 20 years ago as they do now. But in the 2016 election, I started to really investigate issues. Mm-hmm. And I just, because I thought, what are we going to do? This mm-hmm. is getting crazy. Mm-hmm. And I realized I am absolutely not a Republican. I'm a Democrat. But I'm a common sense Democrat. I just want to look at every issue, mm-hmm. understand it in depth, and figure out what's the best for everyone. So I would just do that on my own. Mm-hmm. Just like, mm-hmm. just look through things and read articles and understand really, truly what was happening with an issue. And I thought I could run for office, but I had no idea how to go about doing it. And my mom passed away about a year and a half ago. My brother moved in with my husband and me permanently. Mm-hmm. And so it was difficult, but it's at the same time, I know where he is all the time. And my mom passing, she was ailing for a long time. I had all of a sudden had time. Kids were in college or out of college. And I thought, you know, I could do this, but still didn't have any way to know how to do it. So I met the director of Annie's List in Texas at a party, randomly at a party. Mm. And I asked her what she did. She said she worked for Annie's List. And I said, oh my gosh, I've always wanted to run for office. And she said, really? Which office?
That's right.
Yes. And so she has held my hand and taught me how to do it. But honestly, that's what's great about America. Anybody can run for office. Mm-hmm. And
why this one? Did you decide?
Because I care about it. I have seen it. The people in my district think like me. I mean, I'm a moderate. I think sensibly. I want to fix a problem. I don't want to scream about a problem. I want to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And I think most people are tired, are exhausted with the chaos and with the vitriol. I mean, the fight between Steve Allison and Mark LaHood was jarring. I mean, really, really uncomfortably awful. I mean, what Mark LaHood said about Steve Allison was just lies. I mean, it was just absolute nonsense. And it worked.
Well, along those lines, I mean, you probably expected to be facing Steve Allison, who is the current state representative, and he was beaten by Mark LaHood in the primary, and he had Mark LaHood had support mm-hmm. from Governor Greg Abbott. Steve Allison had gotten crossways with the governor over his opposition to school vouchers. He also had voted in favor of impeachment for Attorney General Ken Paxton. So I what I'm curious about is how that change in the scenario facing Mark LaHood instead of Steve Allison, how that changes your campaign strategy, your messaging for the November election?
Well, to be quite honest, I think it will make it easier. Mm-hmm. I expected to run against Steve Allison, and he is very well liked in my district. And I kind of thought I was going to learn the ropes and have a hard time winning, but I thought I'd learn a lot. But I do believe that Mark LaHood is not the correct choice for mm-hmm. the district. Mm-hmm. And I think that people in our district, we have really good schools. We're mostly Northeast Independent School yep. District and Alamo Heights School District. And Steve Allison voted the way his constituents wanted on vouchers. He voted against it. And as people start to learn what the vouchers will do to the district, I think a lot of people weren't paying attention during the primary. The most extreme Republicans vote in the primary. Some of the regular folks sure. don't always vote. And I think it's going to make my job a lot easier. I think I can do this.
When we look at the history of District 121, I mean, it's been a solid Republican district for ages. This is the district that Joe Strauss represented, for mm-hmm. example, before Steve Allison. But the last couple of cycles that we've had competitive races. I think Steve Allison won the last one by about 10 percentage points. Mm-hmm. I think before that, it was like less than 7% yes. in 2020. So when you look at, and I know that you and your team have been kind of trying to look at the data and the makeup of the district. What do you see? Because there are a lot of people who probably think like you, who maybe just think this is a Republican district. It's going to be too difficult for a Democrat to win. What do you see that makes you think that this is that it's possible for a Democrat to win?
Well, I live in the district and I work in the district, yeah. and my kids all went to school in the district, and I know the people in the district, and you know, I graduated from MacArthur in 1987. So mm-hmm. my parents graduated from MacArthur in the 60s.
I think you said you're like your grandparents like go 75 years.
Yeah,
back.
I think both sets of my grandparents moved in the 50s into District 121. Wow. So been here my whole life. I mean, I was born in the Nix Hospital and came home to a house in District 121. So I know it. And I just think that people are much more moderate than a Mark LaHood, than what Greg Abbott has pushed folks to be in the Republican Party. I think they could use a permission structure to vote across party lines. I think there's an identity with Republicans sometimes. I think that we will give them that because I speak Republican. My husband's a Republican. I was a Republican until 2016.
So you probably had some interesting conversations.
I have been mm-hmm. the token liberal in all of my friend groups for a long time.
You've got a James Carville, Mary Madeline thing.
Yes, we do.
Maybe in reverse.
We do. We do. But it's we really agree on more things than we disagree on. I know people say that all the time, but it's really true. And when they make everything hyperbolic in a commercial or, you know, a statement or a soundbite, it's not what really people think. And it's not what's really happening. They talk about something extreme and they pull it out and they make it seem like, you know, defund the police was what it was really all about, you know, and they make it hyperbolic when it's really not. Mm-hmm. And I think people know that. And I think they're looking for someone who won't be hyperbolic, who will be truthful and honest and speak straight from the heart and not hyperbolize, I don't know how you say that, not make things hyperbolic.
Well, are you prepared for the hyperbolic attacks?
Sure. Sure. I mean, people who know me and love me and are my people I care about know that any ugly attack is not going to be true. We all watched the untrue attacks on Steve Allison. You know, they said he was soft on the border when he voted with Greg Abbott 100% on the border. Right. So I hope that people will, you know, choose to realize that those are extreme, you know, inaccurate comments about me. I'm sure there will be there, but I'm not worried.
When you were thinking about, when you knew you wanted to run for office and you were thinking about 121, what were the issues that were motivating you, that you were and are still more concerned about?
Right. The vouchers are the big thing. I mean, we have been underfunding public schools in Texas forever. We are, depending on which poll you look at, which data you look at, we're 48th out of 50 states in per student funding as it is. Now, as a Texan, that's embarrassing to me. I mean, we're the second largest economy, but we fund our kids less than, you know, we spend less on our kids than 47 other states. Okay, maybe 45, depending on which data you look at. But that's crazy. I mean, the economy in Texas depends on a well-educated youth and a well-educated population. And if we are going to fund kids, rich kids in private schools with our tax dollars and make everyone else suffer, we're gonna head down a trajectory in the economy of Texas that we don't want to head down, and I think that just underfunding schools in general is a problem, and then the vouchers, all that is you know, we will take a chunk of money that is assigned to a student and give it to the parents so that they can use it somewhere else. Private schools don't have to take the STAR test. They don't have to take kids with dyslexia. They don't have to take kids with other disabilities or autism, and so. We're going to take that money, give it to, and the private schools can pick and choose. They can pick the smartest kids. They can pick the best kids in drama. They can pick the best kids in football. It will disrupt everything.
We've also seen in other states that a lot of the families that are getting the voucher money are kids who are already in the private school system.
Yeah, that's
so,
the bottom line.
So it was already happening, and we're
subsidizing
taxpayer money.
You know, right. Correct. And I mean, I think they try to disguise it as best they can. But if people need to really understand what the crux of it is, we're going to take some more money out of public schools and give it to private schools, taxpayer dollars, private Christian schools, private, you know, whatever schools. And I just think that's not what the state is supposed to do. It's not in our federal constitution. I mean, we need to fund our students and our public schools and get them back to where they were. They were the center of our communities. I mean, everybody got excited to go listen to the marching band. People that didn't have kids playing football would go watch the games. I mean, people go to the theater performances and they enjoy those. It's a community activity. Mm-hmm. And we need to get back to that. And I think that was where it was when I was in high school. You know, parents, people from all over the neighborhood would come to activities that were put on at the school, even if they didn't have kids in school anymore. And I think we need to go back to that but this private school, this voucher thing is just nonsense. And he is working real hard and he's funded by outside interests that are really have their own, you know, special interest in mind. And so Greg Abbott had millions of dollars. He spent over $1 million on Mark LaHood's campaign in a state primary.
it was remarkable. Well, yeah. I went to, you know, since the 2022 repeal of Roe v. Wade, which, you know, took away the constitutional right for women to choose. We've seen in the 2022 midterms, we've seen in special elections, we've seen in proposition battles in some states, including some red states, that this has been an issue that's energized Democrats, and generally the issue has gone well for the pro-choice side. How big an issue do you plan to make the abortion issue in this race?
Well, it's a big issue for me. It is. And I would say that every time I have a big issue, some new fire comes ahead that needs to get put out first. You know, like right now it's the vouchers are first. And then, you know, it's funny how, I think I got mostly involved in Democratic politics for climate change issues. And now there's so many other fires to put out that we have to take care of. So vouchers is on front and center on most people's minds, but women's reproductive health. I have four daughters. Mm-hmm. And I got pregnant in college. Mm-hmm. I got pregnant when I was 22 and I chose to have my child, and I had supportive, loving family and grandparents and babysitters and monetary help when I needed it, 'cause I needed it a lot. But I got to make that choice And it was still incredibly hard, so hard to be 22 or 23 and have a baby. And I can only, I think about all the people that just aren't ready to do that and aren't prepared to do that. And for all the myriad of reasons that the abortion ban in general is so bad. I mean, just the healthcare aspect of it. There are, as we all know, there are plenty of women who want to have children who miscarry and they're not allowed to get a DNC, and who have, you know, pregnancies that are not viable, that are not allowed to have an abortion. I mean, there's so many just reproductive reasons, physical healthcare reasons that we need to have abortion be legal and left up to the judgment of the patient and the doctor. But just having four daughters, that is a right that we all had. I've had my whole life. I can't comprehend that it's gone. Yeah. It's hard for me to comprehend that it's gone.
One theory that we've had about District 121, and it's hard to really know for certain just based on election results there over the years, but our feeling has kind of been that even though it's a Republican district, it's Republicans in that district in places like Alamo Heights and Terrell Hills are not necessarily the same as Republicans in other parts of the state. I tend to feel that the culture war issues, social issues that many Republicans run and win on in other parts of the state, that they don't play as well in that district. And that's, and since we were talking about reproductive, you know, rights, I mean, is that your sense?
Yes, it's a very well-educated district. It's a district of people that read a lot of newspapers, that really pays attention. And so I think they disregard the culture wars more so than some of the others. I think that a lot of people kind of think along the lines of Joe Strauss Republicans. Yeah. You know, they're much more moderate, much more centrist, and it's been okay for the last few years I do think the border issue has a plays on a lot of people's minds still in this district in 121.
Sure.
But everything else, I think they can see through, which is one reason. And it's been getting closer and closer and closer, as far as it's very purple. The district is very purple. It's won. The Republicans have won because they've been moderate. I mean, you know, Joe Strauss was moderate. Elizabeth Ames Jones was moderate. Steve Allison was moderate. He's a very pleasant, decent man. And when you try to put someone that's blustery and angry and spewing out culture issues, I just don't think it's going to fly because I don't think they buy it.
Would you welcome a Joe Strauss endorsement?
I would love a Joe Strauss endorsement. He's awesome. He's a great guy. Yeah. And just so well respected and built a coalition in the Texas House that was impressive. And that's the way people want government to work. Mm-hmm. They want us to compromise and get along and figure it out. And it doesn't, not everything needs to be an epic battle.
Yeah. Along those lines, you know, Joe Strauss was, you know, he took a lot of flack from his own party when he was speaker. Mm-hmm. Because he stood up against his party on some big issues, for instance, the bathroom bill,
right.
Famously. And the current speaker, Dade Phelan, is also getting a lot of criticism from his fellow Republicans. And what I'm holding is the contract with Texas, which we have more than 20 Texas representatives or candidates who have signed on to this letter, basically demanding that the next speaker, what I take from it is like not we don't want someone who's going to work with Democrats
right.
on anything, and it's they're saying they don't want a speaker who they want someone who's only going to solicit support from Republicans, mm-hmm. which and we all know Joe Strauss got elected speaker with a lot of Democratic help. They want to end the practice of Democrats being given committee chairmanships, mm-hmm. and other things along those lines. What was your reaction to seeing this?
Well, I mean, that's just part and parcel with the hyperbolic politics we have. I mean, and I don't think people like it. I think they're tired of everybody screaming and yelling at each other. And that's what the Republican Party, the GOP in Texas, wants, is to basically, if they win by a small margin, I mean, they're really not, the state is pretty purple. And they've got to understand that a large portion of the state thinks democratically. And if you just say we're going to disregard,
certainly the big cities right now,
especially the big cities. Yeah. And if you're just going to disregard, you know, nearly half your population, and probably more than half your population, if everyone would vote, we wouldn't have to disregard half that population. So go vote. but it's just a recipe for disaster. And they've had power for so long that they think they can just take more, and that they aren't constrained by any rules. And I just think people are tired of it. There's a rural contingent, which I wonder a little bit how the voucher thing is going to affect the rural Republicans, because Greg Abbott was able to oust a lot of rural Republicans that voted 100% with Greg Abbott. And now they're putting in these even more hardline Republicans in these areas. I think he may have overplayed his hand.
Well, and I guess it's hard for you. I mean, as someone who's never run for office and get elected, you'll be a first time office holder. But are you anticipating a scenario where in the next legislature, it's Democrats are basically just going to be watching Republicans fight amongst themselves?
I do. I mean, that's what has been even, you know, just this year. But yes, it won't be fun. I mean, I think we aren't going to win the House or win a majority, but we have to start somewhere, and we have to start running good candidates that really care, that are in this for public service. And that word has to get out, because I think people are starving for that. But yeah, it's going to be a really rough legislative session if I get there, when I get there.
I think, as you said, even if Democrats don't have a majority, if you can have coalitions of Democrats and maybe a few moderate Republicans, if they're, you know, their numbers are dwindling, but there are some, it's probably a very uncomfortable time for them.
I think so. And I feel for them, but I think that's the road. That's the road we're going to have to take. And I think we're going to have to educate the public and talk sensibly and talk about actual issues and be honest with them about the actual issues. And that's the only way we're going to get people to see that this showmanship is not really governing. It's just not governing.
I think one issue that is certainly as separated pragmatic from Republicans from some of the extremists that we see now is the issue of Medicaid expansion. And I remember having a conversation a couple of years ago with Joe Strauss about it. And I think his take on it was, you know, if you don't want the association with Obama, which is, I think, has a lot to do with why Texas Republicans have resisted taking all that federal money and insuring more than a million uninsured Texans. I think his take was, call it what whatever you want to call it, however we can do this, this makes sense for Texas.
It's fiscally irresponsible. I mean, you can call me a bleeding heart liberal that I want everybody to have health care, but the bottom line is it's fiscally irresponsible not to accept this money for Medicaid expansion. I don't know that probably most of your listeners know what that all entails, but a lot of people don't understand it. That, you know, the Affordable Care Act, when it came out, the federal government was going to pay 90% of the cost to insure low-income folks, but the states had to decide to raise the income threshold. Mm-hmm. So currently in Texas, to qualify for Medicaid, just a regular person, you have to make less than 18% of the poverty level, which is like $3,600. Okay, a year. And then you could qualify for Medicaid. Now, you can be pregnant or you can be a child. Children can qualify for Medicaid. But pregnant women, after 6 months after delivery, are kicked off Medicaid. The Affordable Care Act said if the states will raise the threshold to qualify to 136% of the poverty level, the federal government would cover 90% of the cost to give those people health care. It's like it comes out to something like $5 billion a year that we're not taking from the federal government. Our federal tax dollars, your income tax, is going to pay for Medicaid expansion in 40 other states, but we don't benefit in Texas.
And the assumption was when it was the Affordable Care Act was passed was that all 50 states would do this.
Yeah.
And people necessarily even anticipated that you would have some states filing legal challenges to this. And that's when we ended up in the situation where states had to individually, decide to expand it. And we're at a point now where many red states have joined because they realize it makes sense.
Oklahoma and Arkansas. And we have rural hospitals closing left and right. And a lot of those people, if those folks were covered by Medicaid, those hospitals could stay open. And, you know, I mean, that's just fiscal responsibility. That's a, you know, you might not like it because it was called Obamacare, but it's smart for your state to give 1.2 to 1.5 million people health insurance at the cost, 90% of the cost at the federal government level. That's just common sense. And I think if people understood that, they would say, oh, yeah. And when I explain it to folks, that they're like, really? That's crazy. Is that right? Yeah. They don't know.
I wonder how, I mean, I don't know, maybe you haven't had the experience yet of talking with it, but I wonder how many of elected Republican representatives actually understand it.
I wonder myself. Because it's just common sense. I mean, everybody likes to say, Republicans like to say they're fiscally, you know, responsible. Mm-hmm. And lately, that has just not been the case. I mean, they're the ones that explode budgets and you know, spend money unwisely. I mean, I'm all for securing the border, for example. I mean, we need to know who's coming in. We need to, but it is an incredibly complicated issue that can't be solved by, you know, building a wall or remain in Mexico or Title 42 or all of that is just ham-fisted and not a grown-up way of solving the problem. But it needs to be solved in the federal government, and the federal government needs to pay for the protection of the border, not the state, not our state taxpayers. It's not our fiscal responsibility to pay for the securitization of the border. And so my job would be to work with Chip Roy, to work with, Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, and force them to come to an agreement in the federal government to secure the border. That's who we need to hold accountable for that.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the issue of mental health in your family and how personal it is for you. And I wonder if you see that as something that you really want to focus a lot of attention on when you're in the legislature.
I do. I laugh because every time something goes wrong, we blame it on mental health, but we certainly don't want to put any more money toward mental health. And, you know, folks with mental illness generally don't have money. It's hard to work when you have a mental illness. It's hard to get treatment if you don't have health insurance. It's a catch-22. My brother lived at the state hospital in the early 90s, and he was very content. I mean, Medicaid was covered and kept our state hospital down on the south side open, and it was a lovely place. He had, you know, regular doctor visits, group therapy, facilities that were engaging, and it was a safe place for him to be. And then I remember in the 90s when they slashed Medicaid at the federal level, and the Clintons tried to, Bill Clinton vetoed it, but it passed again. And so they basically gave us a couple of months and said, you've got to find somewhere for him to go, because they shut down the state hospital. So it's absolutely a problem that needs money. And I mean, expanding Medicaid would be a start for sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely a huge focus of mine. I can't even find him a psychiatrist. No one's taking new patients.
Talk about your career up to now, what you've done. And
so I got pregnant young and I worked part-time and kind of was a stay-at-home mom, because with three kids, there's not a lot of jobs you can get and without a college degree that will pay for childcare for three kids. So my husband worked and I worked part-time in retail. I sold, and I had a little job in the old days on 99.5 Kiss. That was kind of fun. I worked with Lyle and Hahn 30 years ago. But I did part-time jobs to make ends meet.
Can you talk a little bit about what you did on the radio?
Yeah.
Well,
people are going to want to know.
Yeah. So yeah, Lyle and Hahn were a couple of guys that were really funny, and they had the morning drive show on 99.5 Kiss.
Number one for years.
For years, yeah. Very clever, very smart, covered the news in a way that made people really get it. And I was a huge fan. Keep in mind, that was 25, you know, I was a lot younger. And they were told by a consultant that they needed to get up their women listenership, and they needed to bring women, have a woman on the show. So they started something called the casting couch. And so, yeah, so once a week they'd bring up a woman and see how she fit in, and she'd just be a part of the show. And my friends convinced me at one point to do it. And after that, they said, you know what? I think she could do this. And so they had to figure out a job for me. I did traffic. I would read the traffic. And I did it for 2 years. It was a blast. It's not a high paying gig, and it had to be there. I had I got pregnant after 4 months too with my second baby.
Serious question. Does that media experience, does it come in handy at all in doing what you're doing, in running for office now, just having gotten comfortable on?
A little bit. Now that you say that, I don't know that I'd thought about it, but mm-hmm. just sitting down to these microphones mm-hmm. felt like I've done this before. It wasn't scary. Yeah. So yeah, because we did spots and we would do remotes and I'd have to talk to people. Sure. Yeah, it does. I hadn't thought about that, but it was a blast. It was one of the best jobs. I had more fun there. Mm-hmm. just got to be a little, not a moneymaker. So I decided to go back to school and got my job. I got a degree in biology because I had so many friends that worked in pharmaceutical sales and it's a good mom job. And so I thought, well, I'll get a biology degree and that's what I'll do. And I sold orthopedic equipment for about 13 years. Then I left and took a couple of years off and worked for my husband a little bit. And then I got a job in a pharmaceutical company. And it's an excellent mom job. It gives you a little flexibility. You work really hard, but you have flexibility. And I've done that for, so I guess a little over 20 years now. Yeah. Still doing it.
We were talking about mental health and obviously Texas has a kind of major problem with, gun violence. Mm-hmm. And we tended to hear our political leaders in the state, you know, say that it's a mental health issue. When I think many would say that it doesn't have to be an either or. You can have, we can have mental health challenges that have to be addressed. And we can also look at the issue of availability of guns, accessibility to guns. But it's the issue of gun reform is always a tough one for Democrats in the state because the guns are such a part of the state culture. Mm-hmm. How do you plan on talking about that issue?
It's hard. I mean, I will say my husband has guns mm-hmm. and I grew up with my dad having guns. We mm-hmm. hunted, I actually just used to ride along, mm-hmm. but you know, I remember growing up and guys would have a gun in the back of their truck because they were going to go shoot dove after school, mm-hmm. you know, and there wasn't the fetishization of mm-hmm. guns. We don't have any more mental health problems than any other nation on the planet. And we do have the gun violence problem. So mm-hmm. it's not just the mental health. It is the mental health. It's certainly an issue, but it's the guns and it's the proliferation of guns. And I think most, even my husband, thinks some common sense gun control makes sense. I mean, we should have background checks. Mm-hmm. There shouldn't be gun show loopholes. You shouldn't be able to sell guns online without background checks. There should be safety, you know, locks and requirements in those situations at home. But it's all a part of the social issues that we're having. Altogether, it's the anger and the frustration that mm-hmm. the country is feeling, whether you call that mental health or just frustration. I don't know. I am not opposed to responsible gun owners owning their guns and being responsible with them, but we can't make it. We've made it so easy for irresponsible bad people to own guns and irresponsible people that don't even have records. You know, it's like an 18-year-old can go buy an AR-15. Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, I need to clarify this, but my brother has had mental illness for 30 years, but he's never had any kind of conviction of any sort. And I think that he could walk in and mm-hmm. fill out a form and buy a gun. And mm-hmm. he's had schizophrenia for 30 years. Because he's never been convicted of anything. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure. But I think that's true.
I think you're right.
And I just think that's like this silly. I mean, yeah. You know, we're saying it's a mental health problem, but we're letting mentally ill people buy guns. Yeah. So yeah, we need to look at this with common sense as well.
You've mentioned that your husband being Republican, also that, you know, that a lot of your friends and family members think of themselves as Republicans. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much you talk politics with them, but if you do, I would imagine you wouldn't want to go into like long detailed political discussions with them, but is there kind of a concise argument that you make to make them maybe rethink their political orientation?
You know, I will say, so in my conversion in 2016 to deciding that I was actually Democrat, I spent 5 or 6 years screaming at people, I mean, getting invited, you know, yeah. I'm exaggerating, but mm-hmm. picking fights and trying to like read
being,
this article.
Being hyperbolic.
Yes, I was being hyperbolic and I was being accusatory and being, you know, falling into the same trap. And I will say this, if you're a frustrated liberal person, get active and do something because it has changed everything that I'm actually running for office. I mean, I probably could have gone and just been a precinct chair and felt like I was doing something. But running for office has made it, first of all, people want to know now what I think mm-hmm. instead of me forcing my thoughts on them. I'm a lot better at listening to what other people think because mm-hmm. I really need to be better at listening to what other people think and understanding where it comes from. And I think that's what I would advise people to do. Try to listen to what other people, where they come from and why they feel the way they do. And because it's usually based in something that you can understand. And I think understanding where other people come from is the key. And I had a counselor, we did a test, my husband and I, and I was an adventurer and he's a peacemaker. And I realized that every time I was getting in a fight, it was stressing him out, you know? And so you just think how many people are like that or just different than you and don't like to go head to head and toe to toe and would prefer a quiet conversation. And I think that kind of thing is helpful for me.
It's really interesting because my dad and I used to have very friendly, but we'd have political debates when I was younger. And I think it was really stressful for my mom.
Yeah.
And at a certain point I would say, oh, I'm just going to stop because I realized like, you know, we were just bantering in our eyes, but you know, but it probably
it's not enjoyable. It makes people really stress out. And I realized that does that to people. And I thought, well, that isn't going to turn anybody else on.
There you go.
Certainly not going to win anybody over.
Laurel Jordan Swift, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Good luck on the campaign trail.
Thank you all so much. I really appreciate it.
And for those listening, we really appreciate it. And I hope you all are doing well. We'll be back next week. Take care.